This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. This afternoon, journalist Dana Sachs joins us to talk about living in Vietnam. She lived in Hanoi in the early 90s when the country opened its doors to American tourists for the first time since the war. Dana Sachs is the author of The House on Dream Street, Memoir of an American Woman in Vietnam. This is from the book's prologue. This is a story about Vietnam, but it's not about the war there. It is a story about Vietnam much later and about one American woman's life in that country. It's the story of a love affair with a place, a love affair that I never would have predicted. I was born in 1962, and when I was a kid, the words Vietnam and war were interchangeable. People asked questions like, when will Vietnam be over? And for me, at least, such a question didn't sound strange at all. I'd never heard of Vietnam except as war, and the place itself conjured nothing in my mind but dust and blood and wailing faces. The conflicts had been going on my entire life. Listeners, I invite your telephone calls for our guest this afternoon. Your questions and comments are encouraged. Here are the numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Dana Sachs has written for many magazines and newspapers, including Mother Jones, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the Philadelphia Inquirer. She has translated Vietnamese stories into English, and she's the co-director of an award-winning documentary on Vietnam, Which Way is East? Sachs teaches journalism and Vietnamese literature courses at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. Her book, The House on Dream Street, is published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. 333-WILL, toll-free, 1-800-222-WILL. Dana Sachs, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for having me.
Sure, it's a pleasure. It was a pleasure reading this book.
Thank you.
When did Vietnam become a place for you that was not tied to war?
Well, I first went to Vietnam in 1990. I was a journalist, but I was at that time traveling through Asia. And when I was in Thailand, I found out that Vietnam was starting to give visas to American tourists to visit the country. So I decided to go. And I was traveling with a friend, and we started in Saigon, which is now called Ho Chi Minh City, and traveled north to Hanoi, and we spent about a month there. And I sort of went, I had a sort of a sense of obligation, like, I'm an American, I need to see this place. And I just expected it to just bring back all these images of the war that I knew from television and the newspapers from when I was growing up. And I got there, and there were definitely images of war, and there were things that reminded me of war, but I was so surprised to find how much more there was than just that. And so I became really fascinated with the country in a different way, and I think it was really on that trip that I started to see it as a country separate from the war.
Yeah, and it's a very complex country.
Oh, very, very. I mean, you never know exactly what to expect with people there. I often thought that they would be angry at me because I'm an American, and they were actually quite anxious to become friends with me, maybe because I'm an American also. They had moved beyond the war in a way that I think people in this country haven't been able to do. And so there were all sorts of things that I just had to kind of figure out as I went along about what the culture was and what people were thinking about and that sort of thing.
Yeah. You tell a story in the book about going to see a film, Indochine, with some friends and mm-hmm. and having in one sense an argument about the war and in another sense joking about it. Would you tell us that story?
Sure. We went to Indochine, which is a film about the French colonial period and the Vietnamese Revolution against the French. And I went with two Vietnamese friends who are artists. And so in a certain way, their reaction to the film was aesthetic. They were talking about how beautiful it was, and they hadn't had an opportunity to see a film that was so lushly made before. And so we talked about that for a long time, but then we started talking about the content of the film, and one of them said, oh, I didn't like it at all. And I was surprised because we'd just been discussing how beautiful it was, and the story was quite entrancing. And I asked him why, and he said, well, they don't know, the French don't know anything about war. They didn't fight the war on their own ground. They fought it in Vietnam, and we're the ones who know about war, and their perspective on the war as filmmakers is totally off. And so we started talking about how people, Americans or French, could report on the war in Vietnam, and it ended up, we're good friends, and so we ended up sort of bickering about it because he was saying, Americans don't know anything about Vietnam. We know everything about America. We know about Disneyland and blue jeans and, you know, American culture, and you don't know anything. And I tend to be a bit apologetic about the war sometimes if people are saying to me or speaking to me, you know, in a more less confrontational way. But he was being very confrontational, so I said, oh yeah, you know everything about America, like America's only Disneyland to you. And so we just sort of got in an argument, and then we were eating in a cafe, and he threw his gum wrapper down on the ground, and I said, how can you do that? You're polluting your country. And he said, well, how can you tell me I'm polluting my country when your country dropped napalm on us? And for a while, I was just stunned, and I didn't know what to say. And then I just looked at him, and I realized he was joking, too. So I just said, well, it's a hard choice, napalm or a Wrigley's wrapper, which is worse, destruction of the country? And we both just laughed.
Well, there are so many points in the book where, you know, as an American, you realize how little we know about this place, even though place names are so familiar, and also the point of view is so different from our point of view and the point of view of the Vietnamese. In Vietnam, for example, April 30th, 1975 is known as here, the fall of Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
There, it is known as the liberation
right.
of Saigon.
Right. It's you have to be over there to start to look at things from a different perspective. I write about John McCain, who was the senator. He was a prisoner in Hanoi for 7 years, and I write about a man that I met there who said he had helped save John McCain when the pilot's plane was shot down and he parachuted into a lake in Hanoi. And this man said that he had pulled the pilot out of the lake and tried to protect him from people who were angry at him. And I said, well, why did you try to protect him? Because suddenly it became apparent to me that John McCain was flying over Hanoi dropping bombs. And I think as an American, when I think about the pilots who were prisoners there, I tend to think of them, you know, I feel sorry for them. I know that their experience as prisoners was terrible, but when I was in Vietnam, I suddenly thought they were having bombs dropped on them. They must have been extremely angry at a man who was doing that.
Hmm.
So it definitely shifts your perspective.
Yeah. This was interesting to think about, too. Saigon now is officially Ho Chi Minh City,
right.
But the people still call it Saigon.
That's right. That's right. I think there's several reasons for that. Partly, it's just much more convenient. It's shorter, and it takes a long time anyway to mentally change the way you call a place. You know, if you're used to calling it one thing, it's sort of always that to you. But I also think that for Southerners especially, it's a small form of rebellion because a lot of Southerners obviously were supporters of the regime that fell when the North Vietnamese took over and the regime that was allied with the United States. And so for them to call it Saigon, it's sort of a way of saying we still don't approve of this change, and we certainly don't want to call it Ho Chi Minh City because Ho Chi Minh is such a symbol of the government and the regime that took over.
Hmm. The book opens in 1992, and you found your friend Tra's house. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Close enough.
Close enough. And you're helping her make dinner, and she asks you, what is the word in English for a person with a nice face, so nice that it means good luck for their children, a face that means good destiny? And then you tell the reader, you never thought much about destiny, but in Vietnam, it is fundamental.
That's right.
Tell us more about that.
Well, it's a culture that believes very strongly that while you have an individual's ability to determine some aspects of how your life is going to go, a lot of things are not under your control. And so, therefore, when things go wrong, people have an ability to say, well, that was just fate, or that was my destiny. It's a coping mechanism, sort of a cultural coping mechanism, and I think it's one way that they've been able to live with having experienced so many years of war. They can say, well, that's our destiny, and move on. Once there's peace, they can move on and say, well, that it was our fate to have war during those years, and now we can enjoy peace. Whereas I think in this country, we kind of go over it and over it and over it in our heads and say, what did I do wrong? What did we as a country do wrong? What might we do differently? And it's just a different way of looking at life experience.
Mm. And the absence of war has to, I mean, it's hard for an American to really grasp that, I think, how torn apart the country was for so long, for so many years, and the Vietnamese fought in so many different nations.
Oh, absolutely. They fought, in this century, they fought the French, the Chinese, the Americans, Japanese, Cambodians. I feel like I'm leaving something out, but I mean, that in itself is, it was almost continual war for 40 or 50 years, and so they have a sense of the importance of peace that I don't think we can understand at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have an aversion to war in this country, mostly because of our experience in Vietnam, but the Vietnamese know it firsthand, and almost everybody has a connection to somebody who died or is missing or was injured or, you know, suffered in some deep way from the war.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have that in this country, luckily.
2 million Vietnamese were killed.
Right. That's even, I mean, some people say that's a modest estimate. Some people say 3 million. It's impossible to know because they just couldn't keep, they don't have accurate, you know, ways of determining how many people died. Some people just were never seen again.
Yeah. You were a girl during the later years of the war.
Mm-hmm.
Were you aware of the war, and how aware were you?
I write about it in my book. I was aware of it in this kind of global way. It was like something that was overshadowing life, but I didn't really understand it. I would see it on the news at night, and I was born in 62, and so I was 13 when the war was over, or 12 and a half. And so I didn't have, I remember thinking that the war had always been going on, and I couldn't conceive of it not continuing, you know. And so in that way, it had an effect on my life because it felt like the United States would always be at war. But I didn't have a real understanding of what was going on, and I really didn't have that until I started becoming interested in Vietnam in the 90s. It just sort of became a historical point of reference for me while I was growing up after the war was over, but I never really investigated it until I was an adult.
Yeah, and it's so interesting that your husband Todd is just like 2 years younger than
mm-hmm.
you are.
That's right.
And his experience, his awareness of the war growing up was quite different, and it also shaped his, how he viewed Vietnam was different from how you viewed the country. Even though there's just a couple of years difference.
I think the ages between 13, I was 13, he was 11, I think that those are years in which you can experience a lot. And so I probably have a bit clearer memory of it than he does, and so for him it was even more of a sort of point in history and not something that he could remember so clearly. So when he came to Vietnam to visit me, he was even less kind of connected to the war than I was.
Hmm. This was so interesting to learn. Military terms remain in use today in Vietnam, but they've taken on new meanings.
Uh-huh.
Talk with us about noodles without the pilot.
Oh, right. Well, noodles are something that, like rice, are a staple in the a staple in Vietnamese culture. If people don't have any money, then they eat just plain rice, or they just plain noodles. And having meat to accompany these dishes is considered a luxury. These days, people can, especially in the cities, people can afford to have meat at almost every meal. But during the war, it was a period of extreme deprivation. Even having noodles or having rice was considered something a little bit special. I mean, people were often reduced to eating just root vegetables and whatever they could sort of scavenge. But during that period, students often developed the sort of cutting-edge lingo in a basic dishes during the war years, like just plain noodles, would want to eat meat but not be able to get it. And so they started comparing it to airplanes, which the Americans were then flying over Vietnam. They had reconnaissance planes that didn't have pilots. They were unmanned aircraft. And so those were called airplanes without the pilots in Vietnamese. That's a literal translation. And so the students would jokingly call their noodles without the pilot, because mm-hmm. it didn't have the essential ingredient, which was meat.
Yeah. And for you to order this in Vietnam was pretty funny.
It was very funny because when I first went to Vietnam, I wasn't eating red meat. And so I was trying for a while to continue that. It eventually proved too difficult. It was too much trouble to explain to people that I didn't eat red meat, because they simply couldn't understand why somebody from a Western country who had money would choose not to eat meat. And so for me to go into a restaurant and order a dish without meat was strange to them to begin with. But the reason I ordered the noodles without the pilot was because I asked a friend, how do you order vegetarian noodle soup? And she was just joking with me, and sort of she didn't tell me what it really meant or the historical significance of the term. So instead of just telling me telling me exactly how to say I would like noodle soup without any meat, she said she taught me how to say noodle soup without the pilot. And so it was really funny for an American to order something using the lingo of the war years. It sounded kind of ridiculous to people, and they were laugh at me a lot, and I didn't understand why until for a walk, and then I'd come home to my room and just sort of sit in there for hours, just enjoying the privacy and feeling like it was hard to bear to go outside and have people staring at me to that extent. But eventually I got kind of used to it, and I just sort of ignored it after a while. And I think at least in my neighborhood, people got used to seeing me around, and they didn't stare at me to quite the same extent. It also, I mean, people, foreigners complain about that aspect of traveling in Vietnam, but it had some advantages to it too, which was because I was a foreigner, I had access to things that Vietnamese people wouldn't have. For example, when I became interested in Vietnamese literature and started reading it, you know, sentence by sentence, very, very, very slowly, people would say to me, friends of mine who were also interested in literature would say to me, oh, would you like to meet the author? And I'd say, oh, of course, sure. It's not like I could ask somebody in this country, oh, I'm really interested in meeting Toni Morrison. Is she available for me to talk to? But in Vietnam, because I was a foreigner and I was interested in this literature, they were flattered by it. And so I got to meet all sorts of really interesting people. And that was wonderful and fascinating to me.
Yeah, and tell us about your English, your Vietnamese tutor.
Oh, he was a very interesting man. He's a linguist by profession, but because of the skewed economy in Vietnam, he got almost nothing for his work. I'm not exactly sure what he made, but it was probably something like $20 or $30 a month, which is very little even in Vietnam. It's not enough to live on, and so he would tutor me as a way to make a little bit more money, because I would pay him. I think in the beginning I paid him maybe $2 an hour. So if he tutored me for 6 hours a week, that would be an additional $12 that he could earn for his family. So that was a great job for him, but it was kind of. It always seemed a bit ridiculous to me. It was sort of like the same thing as this American being able to meet the most famous writers in the country purely because she's an American. He was one of the most, I think he was a brilliant scholar, and he was doing amazing work on linguistics. So it was sort of like the equivalent of
talked a little bit earlier about idea of destiny in Vietnam being fundamental, but it strikes me that poverty is no longer seen as destiny.
That's true. People, the thing about destiny is that it's complicated. You can struggle to avoid it. I mean, there has to be some explanation for the fact that the Vietnamese were responsible for one of the most extraordinary revolutions in the history of warfare. So if they didn't believe that they could take matters into their own hands to some extent, they never would have done something like that. So there's a fine balance between having a sense that destiny is involved in what happens in your life and feeling like you can do something to improve your situation. And you see that in in the 1990s and the ways that people work extremely hard to try to improve their lives economically.
Mm. Our guest this afternoon in this portion of the afternoon magazine is journalist Dana Sachs. We're talking with her about the years she spent living in Vietnam. Dana Sachs is the author of The House on Dream Street, Memoir of an American Woman in Vietnam. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join the conversation this afternoon with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Dana, why precisely did you fall in love with Vietnam? What, is there any one thing about it?
I think there are many things, but one of the things that really was important to me is also one of the things that bothers a lot of foreigners about this place. We were talking earlier about the lack of privacy and the fact that people were staring at you all the time if you're a foreigner. The flip side of that is this sort of fluidity of the culture that was so different to me from American life. And what I mean by that is that when you live in the United States, for the most part, you are isolated by your family or your friends, and you don't really know the people around you in your community. You might know your next-door neighbors, but you don't have a kind of intimate relationship with them. You just might know who they are or, you know, do favors for each other, water the plants while I'm away, something like that. In Vietnam, it's very, very different. People are always involved in each other's lives, and it can be anything from people living, younger generations living with older generations in one family, or a sort of village life, even within the urban, in an urban environment where neighbors really are completely involved in each other's lives, not necessarily as friends, but knowing what's going on with each other and taking care of each other, so that, like my landlord and landlady, they had a small son, and they could feel perfectly comfortable with him kind of running in and out of all the neighbors' houses and up and down the alleyways in the neighborhood, and knowing that other parents or just any adult in the area would keep an eye on him. And that sort of thing was lovely to me, and I liked the way that everybody seemed connected to everybody else, and I started to feel like I was connected and becoming a part of that system. And although sometimes it would drive me crazy, like I felt like I was being watched a lot, I also liked the sense of the connectedness between people.
Mm. And the greeting is not so much how are you, but where have you been?
Right.
Where have you been? Let's talk with a listener on the toll-free line in Joliet. Good afternoon.
Hi. I'd like to ask your guest if there's been any ongoing effort to rehabilitate all the wounded people from the war, and if the effort is equalized between the South and the North.
So you mean within Vietnam?
I mean within Vietnam.
I can't tell you exactly what's going on, but there definitely are a lot of efforts at rehabilitation. The problem, of course, is money, and the country is still struggling just to feed people. So things like prosthetics for people who lost limbs, job training for disabled veterans, that sort of thing. They have those things, but not to the extent that is needed. And so you still see veterans on the streets begging, sometimes children begging, which is not necessarily related to the war. It's more related to poverty. But there's definitely an effort, and there's an extensive network of community groups and civic groups doing that sort of thing, but it's not nearly enough. And as far as is it connected between the North and the South? And the government is a government for the whole country now, but there might be different emphases on the North versus the South. And I know that soldiers who fought for the South, meaning the southern side and allied with the United States, have not had nearly the kind of aid in rehabilitating themselves that soldiers who fought for the North had.
Do you remember the scene from Gone with the Wind? It was the most impressive one in the book for me, where they were discussing, Melanie and Scarlett and the other ladies were discussing decorating the graves of the Yankee soldiers, and the idea was, Melanie spoke up and said, well, if Ashley hadn't come back yet, if Ashley had died and were buried in the North, I would like someone to do this act of kindness for him, and I wondered if the people sort of reconciled or moved towards the reconciliation between Northerners and Southerners who fought on the different sides?
Sure, I think so. I mean, the war ended 25 years ago, so it's still fairly fresh. I mean, I live in the South in the United States, and it's still kind of fresh here from a war that was fought.
We're very bad losers.
That's right. But in Vietnam, I think there is... there is some reconciliation, for sure, but I do think that people in the South, some people in the South still feel like they don't have control over their own destiny. They feel like they're being controlled by the North still. And the other thing is that these tensions between the North and the South in Vietnam go back 1,000 years, so it's not something that would be eased very quickly anyway. And even if the war hadn't taken place, it would have been a complicated, kind of resentful situation.
I don't know. I think that reconciliation between people is when people can respect each other's decisions, even if they disagreed with them. They can find some righteousness in them or some sense of integrity for the other human being. Mm-hmm. It's been fun talking to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Other calls are welcome, 333-WILL in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free, 1-800-222-WILL. Talk with us. This was interesting to read about, is that the North and the South are different places. They have different customs. The food is different. Maybe you would talk with us about how a day in Hanoi would be different from a day in Saigon.
Sure. I think that I do think that the comparison with the North and South and the United States is something that can be instructive. I think the differences between the North and the South in Vietnam are more pronounced, mostly because it's still very difficult for people to travel, and they don't have the money and the infrastructure, the roads, the train system, the bus system. It's just not as good as it is in this country, so there's not as much sort of mixing between the North and the South. But the differences, I think, come out of the difference in the terrain. The North is always seen as being a hard place to live, and that you have to work very hard in order to grow rice, in order to feed your family. The summers are very hot, the winters are very cold. I mean, not cold like snowing, but cold if you don't have proper clothing and proper insulation in your house. So Northerners consider themselves, and I think are considered by Southerners, as tougher and maybe hardier, and they see themselves as not having had it easy. And they see the Southerners as having had it easy because the South is very lush, and it's easy, much easier to grow things, and it's much more plentiful, and the variety of food is much greater. And so the Southerners these are stereotypes I'm describing, but there's some truth in them, and to a certain extent I'm saying what the outsider says about the person. So the Northerners will say that the Southerners are more don't have to work as hard and have an easier life. The Southerners would say for themselves that they're more easygoing and open, and while the Northerners are more wary of outsiders and harder to get to know. And from my experience, those, of course, is not true for every individual, but I think I did sort of see that those stereotypes, there was some truth to them.
Hmm. Let's talk with another caller, a listener in Terre Haute. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I was wondering What would a U.S. citizen who was a male and obviously of military age during the Vietnam War, what could you expect if you were traveling there, and if would it make any difference if you were with your wife or not, or if you were black or white, or if you were a veteran or a war resister? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
There's a lot of different questions there. I'll try to answer them. I think that as I said before, Vietnamese have moved beyond the war in a way that I think it's been harder for Americans to do. So that a male American traveling through Vietnam these days, a lot of Vietnamese would probably not give it much of a thought, like, oh, I wonder what he was here for, or if he ever came here during the war. They might think that he's a veteran returning, and they might ask him about it. But a lot of the veterans who return are there on sort of either personal or organized missions of peace. And so the Americans that make it to Vietnam, for the most part, are very open to the Vietnamese, and I think the Vietnamese who've met them feel that way, and so they feel very warm towards these people. I think that most of the American veterans of the war that I've met who've been back to Vietnam have said that the experience was sort of transformative for them, and it helped them to move beyond the war in a way that they hadn't been able to do before. And as far as the whether you're with a woman, or if you're black or white, I don't know that who you're with would make a lot of difference. I think an African American in Vietnam is something that people don't see that often. So I think an African American might be more likely to be stared at than a Caucasian. But I'm Caucasian, so it's hard for me to speak to what the experience would be like in other ways.
Mm. As a single woman, you were a greater curiosity. So,
oh, yeah.
A single woman, you know, that can complicate life.
Right. I think that I tended to have trouble with married men. Not all married men by any means, but there were some married men who thought, oh, she's single and she's from the United States, so she's sort of looser than Vietnamese women would be, and so they expected me to be willing to go out on dates with them even though they were married, or, you know, that sort of thing, and I found that very annoying.
Mm.
But it wasn't ever, I never felt threatened. I just felt uncomfortable sometimes.
Yeah. You got involved in efforts to get the word out on AIDS and AIDS prevention while you were in Vietnam. We've heard a lot about the situation in Thailand. What's going on in Vietnam?
Well, at the time that I was involved in that, it was still early in the transmission of the AIDS epidemic in Vietnam, and the issue before people who were working on this was to try to stop it before it got to be as bad as it was becoming in Thailand and Cambodia. So what we were trying to do was, I specifically worked on a television documentary to try to explain to Vietnamese people, particularly Vietnamese men, what they needed to do to protect themselves and their families. And the effort was mostly to try not to be try not to make people feel guilty, but try to show them ways that they could protect themselves without necessarily changing their behavior that much if they were not willing to change their behavior. Because studies have been done that were saying that people won't necessarily change their behavior, so what can you do to make it a little bit less risky? So we talked about things like use condoms, or if you can't be abstinent, have monogamous sex. If you can't be monogamous, use condoms, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And here's an area where, as opposed to everyday community kinds of things, in terms of that what you were talking about earlier, the link people have with one another, and people know so much about one another. Here I think is an area where it seems to me, reading what you had to say, is where there is a reluctance to be open and frank about sex.
Sure. People knew very little. The people that I did have conversations with about sexuality, their experience might or might not have been limited, but their knowledge was surprisingly limited. There wasn't anything like sex education classes in school, and I don't think parents felt that it was their responsibility to teach their children. And so children would just be left to figure it out for themselves, basically. And so that's why, on occasion, I was surprised to find that the information people had was so wrong. Like one friend asking if you could get pregnant from having, from kissing somebody with your mouth open. That sort of thing, which sounds funny to us in this country, but she had no way of knowing. She just didn't. They didn't know how it worked.
Tell us how you got around the city when you were in Hanoi.
When I was on my own, I used a bicycle, which was terrifying to begin with because I wasn't a great bike rider even in this country, and the traffic was extraordinary and it was chaotic. There were rules and laws, but people didn't follow them, and there were very few traffic lights or traffic signs, and so people would just kind of go, and they'd often go the wrong direction down streets. Just whatever was the quickest way to get where they were trying to go, they would do it. It was mostly motorbikes and bicycles, and so I just had to learn to kind of follow along the way that the traffic was moving, and it was scary in the beginning. I didn't drive a motorbike myself, but I also rode with other people on motorbikes, which is something I would never do in this country, but it was really hard to avoid in Vietnam because it was the way that people got around. And it's scary also because Vietnam has one of the worst traffic fatality rates in the world. So it's one of those things that you just do it and you try to pretend that it's not as dangerous as it is.
Mm-hmm. So I have a sense of a lot of traffic in a very busy city. And the street you lived on certainly was very busy. Maybe you would give us a sense of how things looked, what it was like on the street where you lived. Talk with us about the tea stalls and that kind of thing.
Well, at one point in my book, I try to describe the kind of geography of the street because the city is so crowded that no space is left unused in any way. So the street itself would be full of, as I said, motorbikes and bicycles, but also pedicabs, which are called ciclos there. They are bicycles that people use for hauling either passengers or goods. And then there would be trucks and cars and pedestrians in the road. And it was just crazy and full. But then the sidewalks, which were quite wide in many parts of Hanoi because the city was built by the French and they like wide sidewalks, and it was built in a sort of as a leisurely thing. You know, this is a sidewalk people can wander down, and it looked very pretty, but it ends up that people would use the sidewalks for everything from commerce. People would set out things to sell on the streets or on my street there would be my street specialized in washing and repairing motorbikes, so there were dozens of motorbike repair and washing businesses all out in the middle of the sidewalk. And so to walk down the street, you'd have to sort of zigzag around all these motorbikes. And then there would be lottery ticket sellers who would set up little, like a little table with the lottery tickets right by the side of the road so people could pull over, buy a ticket, and move on. And then there would be mostly women walking with baskets balanced on a pole, like a weight balance kind of thing. They would walk down the street and the baskets would hold whatever produce or food they were carrying that day, pineapples or oranges or apples or fish, whatever, and they would walk along until somebody stopped them to buy something. And then there were these tea stalls, which would be run by the people who lived in houses right along the street, and it was just a little bench and a little table, and the woman, usually woman who ran the tea stall, would sit there with some tea and some little cups and cigarettes and maybe some candy. And this was a place where all the people that did work in that particular area, like the motorbike mechanics or the lottery sellers, would sort of hang out during the day and talk to each other and kind of gab while they weren't working.
Hmm.
So it was very busy.
Yeah. And so then the tea, you'd have tea in the tea stall or at the tea stall, and then you'd go somewhere else to have noodles.
Right. There would be on my street, there were a couple of noodle shops that were across the street, and you could just walk over there. And often they would also be set out on the sidewalk, but there might be a little space inside the building that faced the sidewalk, whether that was somebody's house or a business. And that space would often have tables in it, too, where you could go and eat inside.
Mm. Really fascinating. Thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Dana Sachs has been our guest. She's the author of The House on Dream Street, Memoir of an American Woman in Vietnam. The book is published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill.